session number 26367, Reel 3.
Commander Stephen. Commander Stephen, Reel 3. We were talking about your time aboard HMS Suffolk with the home fleet based at Scapa from September 41 onwards. I wanted to ask you about what life was like in the wardroom mess and what the food and generally what it provided for you.
Well, I can only tell you firsthand about the gunroom.
Sorry, I said the wrong thing. I mean the gunroom.
Gunroom, yes. Well, it was quite small, whereas the wardroom had the mess room where the table was, and then another space of more or less equal size where the armchairs and the bar were. In the gunroom, we only had one compartment, I think, was the word we used. And that was almost full of the table. And by this time, the table wasn't big enough to seat all the gunroom officers at once, because we had...
you mentioned that you had the extra.
Extra. Sub-lieutenants, RMVR. In fact, some of the sub-lieutenants graduated to become wardroom officers, because the gunroom was so small. It was only designed to carry midshipmen and one sub-lieutenant who was known as the sub and was traditionally the chairman, as it were, of the midshipmen.
Now, what about the food in the gunroom? What was the food like?
Well, considering there was a war on, it was pretty good. There was certainly no shortage of food, and our messman was quite clever at getting us good meals. We used to complain endlessly, of course, and our messman, this PO steward, was very clever. When he thought that we were getting too bolshy, he would lay on an absolutely splendid meal and have everybody happy again. It was strange to recall, but in those days, the messing was very much a commercial undertaking between the chief steward, or PO steward in the case of the gunroom, and the officers. And there used to be a contract drawn up that he would provide so many hot meals a week and so many cold dishes and so on. It was quite a minutely drawn up legal document stating his obligations to us and ours to him.
Were you allowed to drink? I mean,
yes. You weren't allowed to drink spirits until you were 20. But otherwise, you could drink, and it was unrestricted. And of course, from time to time, being 18-year-olds or thereabout, we'd overdo it, and then there'd be terrible retributions, which meant, at the very worst, it meant closing the gunroom bar for a period.
Did you drink much?
In a word, yes.
And how did you get on with your fellow midshipmen? I mean, were they a good crowd?
Yes, they were very mixed, because we had, by this time, we had not only the RN midshipmen, but we also had RNRs and RNVRs. And so We had very diverse backgrounds, but we all got on very well together.
Was there anybody notable, or you know, anybody you remember in particular, either because they were famous or just because they were your close personal friends?
No, then I don't think any of them became famous. In the Navy, everybody, all your messmates were your greatest friends, just so long as you were together. And then when you or one of them left the ship, that was it. You never saw them again. That was the way we lived.
What's the next thing you remember? I mean, you had this convoy to Russia.
Yes.
PQ-1 at all.
Yes, the PQ-1 to Murmansk.
And then what's the next thing you remember?
The weather in these high latitudes could be extremely rough. It reached the worst one night when we were on passage from Iceland to Scarpa, when even the 10,000-ton Suffolk was forced to heave to. Seas were breaking over our stern, and eventually smashed the depth charge rail on the quarterdeck. And live depth charges began to roll about. The officer responsible for him and his mate gallantly set about recovering them, but one eluded them and rolled over the side. Fortunately, it was set to explode at a deep setting, but it was still close enough to damage the A-bracket, which held the after part of one of the four propeller shafts. I was asleep in my hammock right aft, in the nearest inboard spot to the explosion, and was woken by the sound of it, followed by the patter of many feet running to the nearest ladder and up it. I thought of following them, but decided that if there was any danger, there would be a pipe to this effect, and so I just went back to sleep. In fact, there was no danger to life or limb, but the damage meant we would have to dock without delay. So we were ordered to continue south to Newcastle, where there was a dry dock available. There we were given a few days' leave, and also, while watch on, I was able to visit my maternal grandmother, the only grandparent I knew, who lived near Chesterley Street, and I also attended a dance with my cousin, at Heaven on the Wall. Right.
Now, after the dry dock, you went back to Scapa. What's next after that?
Well, the next thing was that I did my time in the Admiral's office.
What did that involve? Was that on the Suffolk or...?
No. The thing was, I don't think I've actually written it down here. This cipher watches used to be kept very largely by Paymaster Midshipmen. And the Commander-in-Chief, who was... Admiral Sir John Tovey, always known as Jack, he used to have section officers of his in the Admiral's office, and each section officer used to have a paymaster midshipman as an assistant. And we all had to do this duty in turn.
Now, where was the Admiral's office? Was it on his flagship?
Yes.
King George V.
And then, after we'd had a collision when I was in her, he shifted the flag to the Duke of York.
Now, tell me what exactly you were doing in the Admiral's office and what it was like.
Yes. We did two things. One of them was cipher watch, And of course, that one kept watches for that because it was a day and night thing, receiving and to a much less extent sending signals in cipher.
So pretty much the same as when you've been on the Suffolk.
Oh yes, yes, that was the same, except that it was more intensive. There were more of us, and there were more signals.
That was one part of it.
And the other thing was to assist officers of the Secretariat. There were he had a number of lieutenants, and each one had a particular aspect of his duties to cover, and each of them had a paymaster midshipman to assist them when they were available, and that was one of the things that that I did.
So you mean secretarial duties?
Yes, and I was doing operations section.
And what, typing out the orders, or is that what sort of thing?
What sort of thing? Well, the the cipher, well, what are we on? Cipher watches, I said.
No, I mean, this is the secretarial thing. So
yes.
What exactly were you doing? I mean, were you typing or what, taking notes? Or?
One was drafting, mostly, so it was probably done in longhand. Drafting letters. To Admiralty, mostly, I suppose.
On dictation, then?
Drafting, and then to go to a senior officer in the Secretariat who would probably amend it, and eventually it would be approved by the by one of the
so
top people in the Secretariat.
Drafts,
yes, that's right.
In answer to.
That's right. Yes, yes. Signals and letters.
Now, did you come in contact with Toby?
No, not really.
What was his reputation at the time? Was
he was a quiet man, and he didn't have much of a reputation. He wasn't one of the gung-ho boys, you know, but always in action and so on. I'm sure he was probably a very good man for their command at that time. He just was a quiet man who got on with the daily task and expected others to do the same.
Now, what about this collision while you were aboard? What were the circumstances? Or were you aware of what was going on? I mean, what happened? Was this just a collision in Scapa?
No. It was at sea. Now, the sea was often extremely rough in this as north as we could get south of the ice, up to the edge of the ice, and it could be extremely rough, and I remember one occasion, I was in the gun room having tea.
This is where you're still with the King George's family.
That's right. Yeah. Or it might have been Duke of York, because they, yes, it would have been King George V, I think, that time. But they're all mixed up in my mind, because they're absolutely identical. Absolutely identical ships. Anyway, I was having tea in the gun room when the battleship gave a sudden shock. It was enough to cause me to rush up on deck. And I was just in time to see the two halves of the destroyer Punjabi sliding past on either side with dozens of men in the icy water. What had happened was that fog suddenly clamped down. The flagship's escort was ordered to take closer station. And the Punjabi, which is a tribal class destroyer, turned in and failed to straighten out again in time. As a result, we ploughed into and cut her in half. When I say we, that was the King George V. And I was having tea in the gunroom at the time. I felt this terrific shock and ran up on deck and was just in time to see two halves of the destroyer, which turned out to be the Punjabi, floating past us, and a lot of men in the sea, in the icy water. We didn't do anything, but the destroyers lowered their boats, or rushed to the spot and lowered their boats, and in fact there were very few casualties. But a higher proportion of officers' casualties, because we hit her in the boardroom at tea time. And for that reason, the proportion of officer casualties was very high. But overall, the casualties were not serious. But the ship was cut in half and she sank.
Now, what damage had been done to the KG-5?
It cut a hole in our bow, just above the waterline. The bow was stove in and of course, opens the elements. So, the commander-in-chief and his staff simply transferred to the Duke of York, which is a sister ship to the King George V and identical. And so we moved across and got on with the same work in what was essentially the same ship.
Now, how did you feel about big ship? I mean, the Suffolk is a big ship as well, actually. But did you have any, these huge battleships? I mean, did you have a preference for battleship service?
Yes, I don't think anybody really liked serving in the huge battleships. It'd be difficult to get to know everybody on board, even all the officers, and. But they would be changing, of course, a lot. But remember, I was still a midshipman at this time, and there was always a proportion of the midshipmen in the flagship to assist the cipher. Have I said this?
Yes, you said that.
Yes, cipher duties, and also assisting one of the section officers in the secretariat. I think I've told you that.
Yes, you told me that. So, how much longer were you on the Duke of York then?
Back to the Suffolk in August of 1942.
But when had you gone to the KG-5? Do you have that noted down as well? So, April to August. Now, so what happened when you went back to the Suffolk?
When I went back, I found that she was getting ready for tropical service. And we sailed for the round the Cape to the Indian Ocean.
Now, what do you remember of that? It's an enormous long voyage. It must have been your longest so far by boat.
Yes.
What do you remember of the voyage?
Well, it was uneventful. We enjoyed the tropical atmosphere after the ice the polar weather that we had experienced.
Did you have crossing the line ceremonies? I presume you would have crossed.
Yes, we did. It was a little bit low key, seeing as how there was a war on, but we certainly marked the occasion. There was we did all the traditional things. No, there was Neptune and his court came on board, and people who hadn't crossed the line before were all ducked.
That was you.
Yes.
Good fun.
Yes.
And then, so where were you going exactly?
We went to Durban, where we had a simply splendid time, as you can imagine. Well, endless hospitality, lots of attractive girls, lots of dancing, singing and dancing and fun.
And then where?
And then we went on round the Cape to the Indian Ocean, and what was called the East India Station, which was really, you can think of that as being the Indian Ocean. We were based in or on Trincomalee.
So what was Trincomalee like?
Trincomalee itself is an enormous natural harbour where the whole of the British Navy, I should think, could have anchored. Ashore, there was virtually nothing. There were Indian shops where we could, there were shops staffed by Indians who went in for that sort of thing, where one could buy souvenirs.
Now, go ashore much?
Oh yes, but only for exercise, really. By day, walking. There were playing fields of every description in Trincomalee. It was very well set up for that sort of thing.
Now, what was the situation on the East Indies? You'd gone out there. Now, would that be about September? You got out there. You'd gone back to the Suffolk in August.
Wait a minute. And the plot. When we were at sea in these,
Tell us about keeping watch on the plot, because that's not on the bridge, but it's below the bridge, is it?
Yes.
Explain exactly what it was.
It was immediately below the bridge, and we were in contact with by voice pipe telephone, and the thing like you have in shops, you send a put something in the tube, and it goes hurtling off to the next destination. What I was doing was following a point of light on the chart, not an amateur chart. This was plain paper, which covered 2 degrees of latitude, and that of course was constant, the distance between the 2 degrees of latitude was the same wherever we were, but one had to draw onto that. The longitude, and of course when we were up in the far north, the lines were always touching, if you see what I mean. And then on the equator, there would only be one line of latitude. And
how did you keep the plot?
The paper was on top of a glass, a flat glass, and underneath that were the works which made a point of light move according to the ship's course and speed. And so every couple of minutes you just join up the pencil thing, and so you had a continuous record of the ship's track.
Would you write anything else on it? Other ships reported or directions?
No, you wouldn't. Well, no, what you do, but when you've got an echo from the radar, you'd get, they'd say echo, and then give it a range and bearing, and so you could plot it. And once you've got a couple of these, you could see what its course and speed was, and you'd report that to the bridge. You'd say, plot suggests this object is steering 050, 12 knots or something like that. Of course, when you only had a couple, that was a pretty rough thing. But when you had lots, you could really pin down exactly what was happening.
And what about aircraft? Would they be recorded on the table as well?
Yes, but they seldom were because their speed would be so great in relation to the ship's speed that they wouldn't be on your chart for very long. But of course, if you were being shadowed, the bridge would know all about that much better than the plot would.
Anything else about the plotting table, how it works, and what you did on it?
I don't think so. I'll see what I've written.
Well, perhaps it's easy. What was the general situation on the East Indies station at the time that you were there? What was going on?
Well, by the time we got to Ceylon, that was Trincomalee, which was the fleet base there, the Japs had withdrawn. We were almost the first people into Trincomalee after the Japanese occupation. But there was nothing particularly bold about that. The Japs had, I think, abandoned their plan to invade and to occupy Ceylon by then.
Now, what forces were with you? What ships were with you? Or were you on your own?
Basically, independent. But there would... we'd usually have a destroyer in company for any particular voyage.
So what sort of voyages were you doing? What was the role of your ship, would you say?
Long-range escort duties. We used to escort, typically, troop ships from Ceylon to the Cape, or in the other direction to the... Singapore, but in fact, by this time, Singapore had fallen. And so I don't think we were actually going... east much from Ceylon. It was all south and back again.